There is a horrible, awesome rightness to his death. Somehow there is a rightness to his death and an inevitable surprise in his resurrection. Inevitable surprise in his resurrection. Somehow we say, oh no. And when he's resurrected, we say, huh? And we say, yeah. Like a great image in poetry. It surprises us, but there is a rightness about it, too. There's a horrible, awesome rightness in his death and an inevitable surprise in his resurrection. That makes, yeah.
Is that only because we have some base for that language? Is that what you're saying?
He knows what our language is and he speaks in it. He knows what we've got in our heads and speaks to it. What I'm saying is that, well, after all, you know, if we had the man has had fertility symbols all the time, you know, and that was very meaningful to them. And then one of the most meaningful things in their whole language of symbols was the fertility symbol, because winter was really cold before we had central heating. And I think to answer that, and you say, yeah, that's the language of men. What language did you think God should speak in? You know? Because if he didn't speak in the language of men, if God did not speak to us anthropomorphically, how in the hell would we understand it? You know, oh, that's an anthropomorphic conception of God. What are the alternatives? A squid conception of God. You know, what are you going to do? It's got to be, you know. It's got to be. I've heard graduate teachers say to a poem of mine, well, it's anthropomorphic conception of God. You know, what's the alternative? You know, what do we got? Supreme oneness, transcending space and time, you know. Okay. Oh, great computer! Great? No, not great. You can't say that. Efficient computer! Pretty soon, you know. You know, bend, fold, mutilate. You know, staple. What is it? Staple, don't staple, bend, staple, fold, or mutilate? But anyway. I mean, what alternatives do we have? And to get that in there, because it's a good joke, you know. Oh, remember this, because somebody's going to say, well, of course, I don't have this anthropomorphic conception of God, you know. Or they say, yours is. And you say, okay, what's the alternative? And they say, you know. You know. Of course he's going to speak in our language. Yeah. Of course. What else? You know, if he wants to talk to us, he'll speak in our language. And part of our language is that, you know, sacrifice. Innocent sacrifice. Okay. Unfortunately, those same people... Oh, wait a minute. This inevitable surprise. Okay, there's a horrible, awesome rightness in his death and an inevitable surprise in his resurrection. Now, that makes those two qualities of poetry, you know, make some folks call the crucifixion the most artistic event in the history of man. The most artistic event in the history of man. And they're right. But, you know, but. Unfortunately, those same people would rather be aesthetic appreciators of the spiritual than plunge into the drama of a life of crucifixion and resurrection and feeding other people's spirits. An artistic event. Oh, a footnote. You know, it is a very artistic event. Another artistic event that they choose to overlook is the washing of feet of sinners. You know, that is an incredibly artistic event. You know, wow, powerful, you know. You know, God on his knees naked washing the stinkiest, humblest part of us. What are you really embarrassed at, you know, what part of you are you embarrassed about? You know, feet, lots of times, feet. I got ugly feet. Corns, bunions, you know, toes that go, bleh. Have you ever looked at your feet? You know? If it doesn't work when you're feeling depressed to look in the mirror and cuss and give, you know, flash your, you know, cuss at yourself, just take off your socks. It is great. Put your foot up and then do things with your toes. You'll be laughing in minutes, you know. No, really, do it. That's the best therapy. Better than puppies in a schizo ward. You know, take your socks off, dummy. You know, and then look at those. And they do such neat things. They kind of creep along the floor, and you can spread them apart. Okay. Of course, the life of Christ is the greatest artistic event. God's the greatest artist. You're going to talk about artists? Fine. I mean, is he going to do a second-rate production? I mean, no. He's the greatest dramatist. It has something to do with knowing his audience. Knowing his audience. He knows them. You know, if I'm going to... What I write is going to be good. People are going to hear it in the extent that I know what they're about. Yeah, knowing the audience. Yeah, he's a good rhetorician too. But you know your audience. You know what they're like. You know the human condition. And who knows it best? And who knows the language best? But the Creator. God's the greatest dramatist. It has something to do with knowing his audience. But what we can't forget is that we are the subject of the drama. We are the subject of the drama. And though God wrote something incredibly artistic and dramatic, it wasn't a play or a ritual, which these other things were. It was an autobiography. The life of Christ was the autobiography of God's time on earth. The autobiography. It was not a ritual that was being gone through. It's an autobiography of God. The Gospels are biographies of that person and the time of his on earth. Some people say the Gospel of John is a romance. It's not. It reads like a biography. It's not a romance. The Gospels aren't ritual romances or allegories. They are biography. I said the life of Christ was the autobiography of God on earth, and I'm thankful to say that this autobiography of the Father, Son, Spirit, Brother, Lord is our autobiography too. It's about us. Crucifixion and resurrection is about us because it was about Christ first. Was it an interesting artistic event, a play? No, it was autobiography, and we're not in the audience. We're the subject. If we insist on the drama analogy, we're still not in the audience. If we want to use the drama analogy, okay, where are we? We're not in the audience. We're on the stage, participants in betrayal, crucifixion, and, thank God, resurrection. I pity those in the audience who should pray more and pity less. And there's a way of looking at the world where you're always in the audience. There's a way of looking at the world to where you're always in the audience. People have lived 70 years in the audience and not as a member of the cast, you know. Can watch the drama unfold and criticize and write your little, you know, things for the newspaper about it. But you're not in it, you know. And to be in it, we're in it. Earlier I promised a point of great significance, and then seems like we got off. But here it is. Well, it's that all the participants in the fertility ceremonies knew that a drama was going on. They were aware of what was happening, conscious that a ritual was taking place. None involved in the life of Christ knew what was going on. Nobody knew what was going on. None knew or even for an instant thought a fertility ceremony was taking place. None knew even for an instant that a fertility ceremony was taking place. None knew that the crucifixion, none knew what the crucifixion meant. See? None knew what the crucifixion meant. None expected resurrection. None expected resurrection. The sacrifice in the fertility ceremonies is the It is excuse me, I wrote this so fast that the sacrifice in the fertility ceremonies is understood by all the people in the tribe to be the most meaningful moment in their lives. Christ's death comes as an absurd, horrible, final end of possibility for the disciples, a nonsense ending of their 3 years of ministry with him. First John the Baptist, and then Jesus, and now no one. And we're on the road to Emmaus.
Will you say that again about Christ?
Okay. The sacrifice in the fertility ceremonies was understood by all the people participating and the whole tribe to be the most meaningful moment in their lives. It was an incredibly meaningful ceremony. Everybody knew it. The guy who was being hung up knew it. Everybody else knew it. Christ's death comes in the Bible. If you just read it, you're there. What happens? Absurd, horrible, final end, meaningless to the people who were there. That's what they thought. A fertility ceremony was not taking place to anyone, in anyone's mind. That's what, you know, cosmically was happening. God knew what was doing. He was speaking in the language of men, but the men didn't know it. The men were not projecting this, creating this little drama, because nobody knew it. Christ's death comes as an absurd, horrible, final end of possibility for the disciples, a nonsense ending for their 3 years with him. First John the Baptist, then Jesus, now no one. To the Pharisees, an impostor and blasphemer was being punished. To the Romans, a criminal. Christ was right. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. They did not know what they were doing. Incredible dramatic irony here. And Jesus said it. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. To everyone present, to the whole people, the crucifixion of Christ was the most meaningless event in history. Can you see what that would be like? The Savior, the King of Israel, you follow him for 3 years, bam! You take him down from the cross, you bury him, and you say, what do we do? You know, wow, they were going, the whole thing's over. That's what they felt like. The most meaningless event in history. Dramatic irony. God's folly is wiser, more meaningful, more coherent than the wisdom of men who knew Christ's death was meaningless. Men's wisdom knew that Christ's death was meaningless. God's folly is wiser than that and knew that it was meaningful. God spoke in the language of men in history, and it was not until after the resurrection that men made the connection that centuries of symbol development developed them to make, so that when the Holy Spirit cleaned their ears out, they would have a mind ready to make the connection. The empty dramatic form of the innocent sacrificed for new life to end the wasteland of the winter of our lives was filled with its perfect true content. The form that had been developing for centuries was filled with its true content. The cup was there. Christ said, remove this cup from me, but then said, thy will be done, and he filled the empty cup from which his people have drunk the new spring wine ever since. We didn't have anything to do with spring coming. We didn't say, here comes the sun. We look back, the scales fell from our eyes, and we say the sun is arisen, an accomplished fact. It's a new day to bear much fruit. I think that's a pretty good argument against that position. They didn't know what was happening. The only people that knew were God. was God in the three persons. But the people didn't. Fertility rights, the most meaningful thing to the whole people, to everybody involved. It was an honor to be sacrificed, to be thrown down into the pit if you were an Incan, to be burned on the altar if you were a sun worshiper, or whichever way you did it, whichever way the innocent was crucified. It was the most meaningful thing to everybody. The crucifixion to the people involved was zip. And God knew better. Oh boy.
But why? Why didn't God just, make it plain and say, well, this is going to be the great last sacrifice, and I want you all to take part in all this meeting? Why was it such a mystery?
Well, if we didn't have to make the connection ourselves, we're forced to make the connection. That's the freedom business again.
Mm-hmm.
Christ is bound and determined not to give us anything that we can't disbelieve if we want to. He's going to allow us to disbelieve. The only way that we can freely love him is if we don't have to. That we've got all sorts of equipment, reasons why not to. Okay. Right? Otherwise, there's absolutely... What kind of love is it if I'm some 18th century guy and my wife has to make love to me? Yippee. Big deal. Doesn't mean anything. Freely given. Incredible. Every difference in the world. And God knows that, wants that, and will allow, gives us a mind that is the best weapon against him, gives us a heart that's the best weapon against him, fills the world with beautiful things that are either gifts or weapons against him. Can be both. Ambiguity again, that one question, what do we do with it? Well, you live in it. So let's get used to stretching to be able to take it, because the whole world is that every gift of God is the best weapon to attack him with. Wait a second. Is that answer? Or speak to it?
Sort of.
I can understand it, but I know why. You say, why don't you, God, just give me proof? Well, if he gave me absolute proof, it'd be necessary for me to believe, and not free. I'd have to. I believe in him like I believe in that post. That's no relationship. Incredibly brilliant people sit in the audience and talk about God. Hey, have you heard of the fertility sacrifice in New Zealand in the Ufi-Gadigal tribe? Have you heard the guy who turned the stones into bread and so forth? Isn't it interesting how universal all this is? They're really brilliant. Read some of this stuff. Brilliant. Dull. Read some of this Gnostic stuff that comes out. It's titillating, it's exciting, it's like eating eclairs. There is no body and blood there. Not because they don't have an IQ or anything like that. They think they're in the audience and they're on the stage. They think they watched it instead of were part of it. If you watch what happens in the New Testament,
You're in the audience. You are those guys. You know. Your name is Legion. You know. You are those guys. You're every one of them. You got to know that. Because you're not in the audience. Why should I? I don't know. That's a mystery. I don't know why some people are allowed to ask that question their whole life. Why should I? But like Lewis says, you can't talk to them. You know, all they can do is see somebody in a storm, acting like it's a calm. You know, and feeding, and not insisting on being, you know, using other people, but just giving. Yeah.
You were saying, why did God not make that so that we knew what was going on at the time, and that we have to work out those connections ourselves. That makes it more meaningful when we struggle through that Christ is the Christ, and then you said it was freely given. Christ really gives us this challenge. Is that what you mean? It's meaningful.
Okay.
Because we have to work it out, but then I didn't quite get it.
Okay. Christ gives us enough fact to knock over any opponents to the faith as well as they try to knock over us. Now it's all this projection, you see, expression of the archetypal mind. No one knew it was happening. It wasn't that. It may have something to do with why people understood it, but that wasn't what was going on at the time. You can prove that to people. You can knock out something that they've been using for a long time to keep them away from God. You can take that away from them, and they have to go back to the library. He gives us enough brains, enough Holy Spirit, enough stuff to take those things away, to get it back to the point. Believe or not. You know, you're going to believe it, but Christ gives us enough intelligence, enough Holy Spirit to say that all the alternatives are done on a leap of faith. Why not jump into a better place? That's one of the things, connections from abolition of man. Every position involves a leap of faith. And, yeah.
Can you use that? I had some talks a couple of weeks ago when I was out with a psychology professor, and he came at me with the argument that Christianity, he looked at Christ as a model of behavior, an alternative model of behavior, and showed me all these others.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that would work with him, but I wonder, why not this one? Can you get up against that, just alternatives, and then say, why not give this one a try? I was talking to him, and he wasn't in any of them.
Yeah. Yeah, he's in the audience. Right?
Yeah, I have to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to.
Yeah, it's like an open mind. God gave us open minds so that we could close it on something. I mean, if you don't close it, that isn't mine. That's from some bishop. I read that once.
Oh.
Some reporter asked a bishop, is he from England? And he got off the boat during World War II. Something about, you know, well, what do you think? Don't you think it's, you know, open mind or something like that? And he says, well, God gave us an open mind so we can close it on something. And if you close it on something, you'll find out what it tastes like. But if you have an open mind, you'll never know what things taste like. And if I bite down on Ben Franklin as a model of behavior, you know. But if I bite down on Jesus, not as a model behavior. If I bite down on him there, I end up with a crucifixion. And because the kinds of things that he's saying, you know, are really something. Jefferson cut out all the passages in reference to, you know, any miracles or anything. He wanted Jesus to be a model of behavior, but he didn't die on a cross. And I really think with Lewis that either Jesus is nuts or he was who he said he was. And if he was nuts, I'm not going to follow his pattern of behavior. He's crazy. But that's where I say, I mean, it's he either was who he said he was or he's crazy. I don't. He tells me to hate my mother. He says he's the only one. He doesn't say he's a model behavior. He says this is it. No. He doesn't. And we can't edit, we can't do what Jefferson did and take a regular Bible and cut out huge passages of it. We can't do that. Thomas Jefferson. And something else too is that, see, other people, you know, models of behavior know what the strength of men is by itself. And you use these models and no problem. Christ comes along and makes it absolutely hopeless to be able to use him as a model behavior. He says, here's your law that showed you the model of behavior, and I don't come to abolish the law, I come to complete it. Now, guys, be perfect, absolutely perfect. If you are angry in your mind, you've killed somebody, if you, you know, have adulterous thoughts, boom, that sin is as bad as killing someone. You want to take a guy like that as a model, you know? I mean, he just kind of blows the end out of models, doesn't he? And he just kind of makes it. He tells us how impossible models in that old conception are. Well, he himself ends up that way. I think that can be argued around in some ways because he had a flat tragic flaw. He didn't get out of town, you know, or something like that. But models are... He asks us to do things that is clearly beyond our power by ourselves. He asks us to do things that are, well, in him our lives can be the impossible possibility. Outside of him, it's impossible, see? It's impossible to do what he says unless you're in him. Have his strength. He's the guy who asked you to do something and gave the power to do it too. You know, Confucius gave no power to do what Confucius asked. And he didn't ask nearly as much. Confucius wanted me to be a gentleman, you know. I make $60,000 a year and I've got an Oxford education. It's all right, I'm a gentleman. Jesus is talking about behavior in a storm, really. And how you behave in a storm. And I think lots of the other these model business are how one, you know, okay, all the other models don't do anything for me if I'm in a Warsaw ghetto in 1939 with the bombs coming down. You know, all my syllogisms are not going to do me much good in the third hour of bombardment. You know, they're irrelevant. The Amy Vanderbilts of philosophy are irrelevant in the third hour of bombardment. Christ isn't. As things get rough, his meaning gets clearer and clearer and clearer. And it's harder, I think. I remember driving through Southern California where in this one district that every house is over $100,000. You drive, you know, mile after mile after mile of $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 ticky-tacky. You know, ivy lawns, you know, you go, ugh. You know, you see cars and cars in front of the houses. You say, how can Christ be seen here? And he just say, finally, he can. Because people carry around the wasteland between their ears, you know. And, but my gosh, you know, how could, you know, I said, how could Christ be relevant in a place like this? And then they say, yeah, because the people, you know, are the people. And the divorce rate, you know, they have many, many human problems. And the more escapes they get, the more problems they find. The more they lose their way. But you know, he wasn't a model. These other guys said maybe don't be selfish, but Jesus said die. And and the guys who said don't be selfish didn't give me any power to do it. I mean, Pat Boone told me I should be gentle, kind, and nice. And he wrote it out in a book called Twixt 12 and 20. Thanks a lot. Did you read that when you were a kid? You know, there was a stage in my life where I typed out some of those things, and I carried them in my wallet. You know, for a while. You know, thanks, Pat. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Well, thanks a lot, because I sure found out quick that I wasn't any of that stuff. And that was before he was really, you know, I don't know what he's like now. I guess he's with Oral Roberts and things. I haven't ever heard
they
him
have
since.
They have mass baptisms in his
swimming pool. Yeah. Great. It might be great. I don't know. But at the time, that was a bunch of that Twixt 12 and 20 was just a lot of, you know, that's enough to give anybody a guilt complex. I mean, you know, he sounded like he was a spiritual and emotional eunuch in that book. Doesn't he have any problems? I mean, his problems were these, you know, icky, you know, things. But someone who could actually be gentle, kind, nice, really, you know? It was a lot of superficial stuff, and boy, maybe I should thank him. I think I do thank him, yeah, because I found out that, you know, it didn't do any good to have a model like that. And another thing, I mean, most of the models that we take are nice and gentle and kind and intelligent and all sorts of things, and Jesus wasn't those things. Yeah, Jesus was ripping into the temple with the whips, and he, you know, he goes around, he's out there slumming with the prostitutes, and the sense of his day, that was just terrible behavior. That's what the Pharisees killed him because he wasn't a model. He wasn't a holy man. See? Remember, Christ was crucified because he wasn't a holy man. He was God. You know, because our whole conceptions of spirituality go right out the window if we take a look at Christ. You know? Well, you ask him next time about model, just to like, okay, now, you take this as a model of behavior. Someone's father has died. You know, someone's father has died. And you've got a class.
and someone's father died and says, I can't come to class, I've got to go to a funeral, and you tell him, let the dead bury the dead. That's what Jesus said as a model. You see? Now, would you want to do that? You know? Let the dead bury the dead. Boom! You know, you take that as a model of nice human behavior. You're not a model. In the sense that we talk about human models. There is a sense in which he is a model, but not at all like this other stuff. And that's not the point, you know, of his life. The point isn't that he be a model for us and show us a little thing. Just as the point of the crucifixion isn't this fertility business. I mean, this fertility business is a footnote that I've talked about today. Don't give it false proportion. That's a footnote on a footnote on a footnote. It just was kind of neat how he did it, you know. You know, how God did that, how God pulled off that, gave me that extra dimension of meaning, you know, coaxed me to make a connection, but I had to make it, you know. He set things up so I could make a connection if I truly did, and I did, and that's just another side issue, but it's fun.
One of the things that's really relevant to me, speaks to me in what do you say to somebody? You know, I'm what do I say to myself? You know, how do I understand it better? And in looking at, you know, he can't be a model because a model wouldn't give you something in the third hour of bombardment. And if you see this, and if you see the world, if you're in the storm, you really have to see that as the third hour of bombardment. Mm-hmm.
You are. That's front line of the kingdom business.
And that's always. That's the storm. It's the storm that's around you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important to have gotten some eyes to see that and to see what's around. You know, just, you know, little tiny peepholes of eyes and all.
Mm-hmm.
But and somehow that's that directs me back to the truth and to the real meaning of who Christ is, and then you're cutting away all that extra fat of reasoning and figuring and you know, putting a different image and a different role on it. You know. And that's
yeah. Well, I'm just in that situation. I'm talking to a doctor, and I'm a sophomore. One of his students has taken a couple classes from him. Had dinner with him a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
Chummy, but still.
Mm-hmm.
G. Kurt, you know, you studied some of this and had kind of a year of it. Have you read, have you learned all this other stuff?
Yeah.
These alternatives? Do you know that?
No.
How can you make a choice? How can you jump if you don't know the other?
Yeah, okay. That, let me speak to that a minute. He has neither. I mean, look, I talk about theology, I talk about philosophy, I talk about theology, I talk about poems, I talk about everything. I don't have a credential in the world, except people who do, say, I know what I'm talking about, if they listen long enough. You don't have to read all the damn books. There's an eternity in a grain of sand. You read the Bible. Well, you got it. You don't have to read all these other books. You read one, you can read one psych book and make, you can read one essay, Gnostic essay, and you can go, you know, that baby goes nowhere. You can know. It's a problem of, if you ask the question, should I get out of bed, and you have scruples, you won't. You cannot read all the books. He cannot. To say, have you read the books,
means that you will die without ever having made a commitment. You cannot read all the books. So get that hope out of your mind. Do not talk about poetry because you've only read two poems. Start talking. You're going to be wrong and you're going to be right. But hang in there, you know. Get going. Do it. You can't. I mean, this business of, John, have you read Kant? No, I haven't. I don't know philosophy, but I'm a philosopher. I don't know theology, but I'm a theologian. I don't know poetry, but I'm a poet. You see that? You are that too, you see? You get a year of theology, not theology study. You become theologians for a year, become philosophers for a year, become poets for a year, become logicians for a year, but you're not, don't know anything about rhetoric as a subject, do you? Nothing. But you become that instead of studying it. You're inside it instead of outside it. And it happens. And if you stay outside in the audience, you know, I mean, you'll end up dying in your pew or seat, you know, because you'll never read all the books. You've got to make a commitment. You start asking, I got to read all these things. And then you make a commitment. You really make a commitment to the behaviorism. That's it. That's the absolute truth right there, baby. And if you have any brains at all, you'll find out that that's a lot of crap. I mean, you got the open mind, close it on something. You'll find out what it tastes like. Hopefully. But you've got to do that kind of thing. In this business. You know, I have... Now, Carol would say I'm a good Lutheran. I have never read Luther. I did not have confirmation. I did not read the catechism. I've never read a word of Luther. You know, I've never read a bit of theology. And I'm embarrassed about it. But other things keep coming in. You know. But the stuff holds. You know. And I can't be intimidated. Have you read this? No, I haven't. Is it good? Good. Let me write down. Author, title, good. Why is it good? Okay, got it. SC, number 864. When I'm in heaven, you know. But you can't, you know. You can't do them all. Some of the stuff you do before my bladder explodes and... that commitment business. You make the commitment to this. Then other people then shatter people's expectations of foggy-headed Christians. Oh, you're a Christian because you don't like you don't see the real world. Have you ever met anybody who's seen it uglier than I have? Have you ever met anyone who's seen it as hellish as it is? No, I'm not a Christian because I want to escape from this reality. I say it's real, baby. It's either hell, you know, we are alternative. Either we're in the kingdom or we're in hell. That's it. Shatter those things. That's what part of it is. Celebrate, you know. While you should, by the world's terms, be intimidated. You know, you can keep talking to this guy. Great, keep the talk up. You know, pray like crazy. Listen as hard as you can. See things his way. You know? I mean, try to see it with his eyes. No man is a fool. These guys know what they're talking about. What they're talking about better than you will or ever will. See it from their view. You'll need it someday. Everything you can get. Know that without, you know, What does it, you know, if you don't know Christ, what does it matter what you know? But if you do know Christ, wow, great, know everything else too. You know, but if you don't know Christ, forget it. And in a sense, he frees you to see psych better than you ever could. You don't have to. Is he a Skinnerian? Is he a Maslowian? Is he a Jungian? Is he a Freudian? Which is he? Okay, he's in the audience in psych too, maybe.
It's just that there's kind of a teaching thing. They don't want
to. They can't. You see, damn it, you can't. You're not supposed to do it. That's why I'm teaching here. You're not supposed to say you believe anything. You know? Be objective. Damn it, don't be objective. You know? How are you ever going to see what really means something to a person unless the teacher is doing it? You know? And I get what I believe out, and then you can cut it if you want to. But let's go at it. Then we'll know. I won't sit here and talk about lyric poetry and fine. You know, if you've got Christ, fine. And do that. Learn it. Fine. Know that you believe in it. Because it's not going to sound like many of your teachers are going to believe in it. But they know it. Get everything they know. They know far more than you do about this stuff. Get it. But when you talk about poetry to somebody, you know, believe it. You know, that line, my gosh, some of that stuff. You know, it's sitting out there and diddling with it. Ugh. Oh, excuse me. I don't know if I can't even stand up. Hey, I've got 18 pages of notes that I'll give to you guys, and you can hand them around if you're interested. And I'll give them to you at supper. Oh, boy.